So this evening, I would like to look at letting go in different ways. So I want to look at different aspects of letting go. And to start with, I like to look at, in a way, you could nearly say the opposite of letting go, which is a process of grasping. Because if we want to understand letting go, we also need to understand how do we grasp? And when we grasp, what happens? And to me, I would say that the process of meditation is really a process of de-grasping. Because I think this is, again, for survival mechanism, survival purpose, it's very natural to grasp. It's very natural to want to hold on to things, to want to secure, to want to things for ourselves. I mean, if I don't take care of myself, who will? So generally, we have this immediate grasping. And so there is this very interesting idea in the Buddhist tradition of contact and feeling tone. And so feeling tone, we'll talk more about it tomorrow morning. So the idea is that we have the six senses. So we hear, we smell, we taste, we think, we have sensation. And so through all these senses, we come in contact with the world. We hear something, we see something, we taste something, we smell something, we touch something. And we also touch thought. Because one moment you don't have a thought, and next you have it. And just that contact, then in a way, that's where there is the point, you could say, of freedom, of letting go, in terms of, do I grasp, or do I creatively engage? So I think the term letting go, we have to be careful with also. Because often you hear the term, let it go, let go. And so often we have this idea that we have to let go, you know. And you might have a friend, and the friend comes to you with difficulty, and you said to the friend, let it go. And your friend, I don't want to let it go. I cannot let it go. So that's why, personally, the term I like to use is the term creative engagement. That I think the other side of letting go is about how can I creatively engage with contact. So I come into contact with things, intentionally or non-intentionally, it depends. And what happened? And the question is, do I have the choice? In a way, do I have the choice to creatively engage upon contact? Or does it feel that I cannot? I don't have any choice, and I'm just stuck. And so in a way, the meditation process is a process of helping us to create the space so that then we can have the choice to creatively engage. Or we can diminish the power, the reaction of grasping. And so that's why, in a way, part of what we did this morning, I was talking about anchoring, that's what it's about. In a way, each time you come back gently to the breath or to the body or to the loving kindness phrases, you've made that choice to actually just come back. You brought that space. It's a small space, but over time, it accumulates that power to create a space. In the same way, when you look into the changing nature, when you see, oh, this is gone. It was here, now it's gone. Oh, it's here this way, but if I go inside it, it changes. It's different. then you start to feel that there is more possibility. Because if we grasp and say, this is like this, it will never change. Basically, you are fixing. And so I would say, in a way, the meditation is a way to defix, is a way to bring a little more space, and then there can be a little more creativity. And so part of this mindfulness thing, what do we do when we're supposed to be mindful? What is this mindfulness about? And basically, the mindfulness is about being aware of contact. But being aware of contact in this kind, gentle way, so that we become more aware of actually how we are upon contact. And the fact that I'll talk more about tomorrow morning is that as soon as you have contact, you also have a feeling tone. You see something, you hear something, you taste something, you smell something, you have a thought. Upon that contact, there will be a tonality. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neither or, relatively neutral. And those tonalities have a very profound effect on us. We react very fast to tonality. And also the fact is that it takes us more in terms of pleasant tonality to think, wow, that's great. And it takes us very little in terms of unpleasant to say, no way, I don't want this. So there is a certain asymmetry to that. And then we become more aware, of course, more focused on the unpleasant and much less on what is pleasant, what is good. So first we have the contact. So we come into contact with something. And then it's interesting, that movement. We're in contact with lots of things. But then something have more impact, are more triggering than others. And that each of us have many different conditions. And there is something which will have an impact on us, not on somebody else, and vice versa. But once we grasp to whatever it is, then generally you have a process. And so with the grasping, you have the process of identifying. I, me, mine. Of course, it's not somebody else who is in contact. It is not your neighbor. It is not, it's you who have the contact. But there is a way where we have a tendency to make this me bigger. So you take a bigger part of the picture. And that's why sometimes things happen because they happen. We don't know why. That I get a call, that I get pain in the back, that my brother-in-law dies. Things happen in life. Doesn't mean that everything that happened in life is suffering, but some of it will be suffering. That's life, which happened. Good thing happened, bad thing happened. But when things, we're in contact, we quickly, this is me, this is mine, this define me. And so the problem is that actually we reduce our identity to what we grasp at. This is what we have to see. That actually it kind of really, we can have, and I think meditation is to help us to have a really wide, open, spacious, benevolent identity. But the grasping actually stops that. The grasping has a tendency to fixate, to reduce, to kind of like, we kind of become reduced to what we grasp at. And this is, in a way, what is problematic. So, for example, if we look at thought, what are thoughts? at one level, thoughts is just a little firing in the brain. It's axon, neuron coming together. And I mean, it's electricity. That's what thoughts are, electricity. I think it's amazing, all this electricity in here, doing all kind of things. But we identify with this electricity. This is me, this little psst. This is me. Isn't this strange? It's kind of like saying, you know, you identify with the electric thread over there, you know, this electric cord. This is me. I put the light on. This is me. I take it off. Ah, I am not here anymore. And of course, it's a little more complex because we experience it. I mean, we know the electricity in the wall, and we hope it works, but normally it doesn't do anything to us. But this thought, this electricity in our brain is like, wait a minute, it has an impact. And the more we identify, the more it will have an impact. But it's very hard not to say, this is me, this is my thought, this is my feeling, this is my sensation, because it's me who is experiencing it. So the thing is not saying it's not me. It's not saying, oh, it's belong to somebody else. I mean, I am experiencing it, but how am I experiencing it? So it's really looking, the mindfulness is really looking at that. How am I in contact? How am I experiencing this contact? I come in contact with a thought, a sensation, a feeling, a sight. What happened? What do I do with it? Do I creatively engage with it? Or do I grasp? Because if you grasp and you identify, I, me, mine, then you're going to reduce yourself to what you grasp at. And then this is what is the most difficult in that process, is you amplify. So when we grasp at something, when we identify with something, we are going to make it bigger than it is. And because it is bigger than it is, then it's going to be very hard to creatively engage. So in a way, the idea of the Buddha was, how can we not do this, in a way? How can we not amplify? How can we not make something bigger than it is? And so the idea is basically with the mindfulness to see it partly in context, to see it partly in its conditionality. So in a way, what the practice is trying to show us is that you cannot reduce yourself to any one element that constitutes you. This is what we're trying to see. That yes, I have a thought. Yes, there is a feeling. Yes, there is a sensation. But that is not in isolation to everything around it. And also to my capacity, to my qualities. Because when we become stuck with a difficult thought or feeling or sensation, we have the feeling that it's bigger than us. This is interesting. A feeling, a thought, a sensation. It's bigger than us. And often we say, it's too much. I can't handle this. I mean, when I was really unwell for a few nights, I could feel my kind of like, I could feel this kind of like reduction to this, you know, and it's kind of nearly like your meditation had gone. It was not, I could not activate it. It was very interesting to see that it was like the bigger you make it, the least you can activate your qualities. So that's what we have to see when we amplify what is difficult in that way. Then it actually stops our quality from being activated who could help us. So again, it's kind of like it's in the relationship. And so part of the mindfulness process is still a way to notice. Am I grasping here? How much am I grasping? And what was interesting for me was to decide, come on, I'm going to meditate. I can meditate, even if it's really painful and things of that nature. I can meditate. I can be with this in a different way. But it's so easy, in a way, to forget it, especially if you're in pain, especially if you're not well, because then things will be much more opaque. One wants to see that when we grasp, we identify, and thing becomes more intense, it becomes much more opaque, very unclear. And so it's kind of like things are darker. And so part of the process of not grasping is really there is more clarity, there is more space around what we're experiencing, around the contact. So then there is more balance. So that's what we're looking for. How can we have a contact in which there is balance, in which there is some stability, in which there is openness? So that's what, when we talk about letting go, it's not saying this does not matter. It's not saying I don't care. It's not indifference. But it's trying to bring some balance within the contact. So I have a thought. What is this thought? I have a feeling. I have a sensation. How is that? I hear something. How can I be with that sound? I smell something. How can I be with that smell? So it's kind of like bringing a little space so that not immediately we're going to grasp, we're going to identify. And then also, I think the mindfulness is also to observe. I would say the signal of grasping. So when we grasp, often the signal is amplified. Things become more intense, more amplified. And then you can start to see yourself saying, never, always, it will never change, if it's always like this. And that's a signal. Oh, I am amplifying, I am grasping. And then you could say, I'm not going to grasp. But that's not easy. And then it's kind of looking, what is it that could help me not to grasp so much when I am in contact? So it's back to, what is it that's going to help me to bring some balance? Because in a way, there will be a certain of balance in terms of unpleasant, in terms of intensity, because of that asymmetry. And then, and that's why, in a way, one of the practice, which we're not going to do tomorrow, but the day after, and if you like this practice, you can do them already. The Buddha developed this method of cultivating certain quality. And I feel that that method of cultivating certain quality, like loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity, is actually to bring the balance. So I think we have to be careful of thinking that the mindfulness is just to be aware of the suffering and then help us deal with the suffering. That's not what it's about. Partly it's about, yes, there is unpleasantness, yes, there is suffering. How can I be with that? But also there is a whole practice which is about cultivating balance, helping us to, in a way, bring more balance. within that intensity. And so in a way, that's why those qualities, so tonight we could just look at three. So you have, the first one is what's called metta meditation or loving kindness meditation. And so these meditations are a little different. They're not just about observing. They're actually using intentionally certain phrases like, may you be happy, may you be at peace, may you be safe, or like appreciating my effort, appreciating your effort, or like accepting things as they arise. So for each quality, you have certain sentences. And so when you sit in meditation, you recite these sentences, if that suits you, or you connect to the experience. How can I experience some happiness right now? Am I experiencing a little safety right now? So not 100%, but can I have a taste of it? So in a way, the idea is to bring it in mind, in the experience, and say, oh, can I experience a little bit of happiness, or a little bit of peace, a little bit of safety? Can I connect with that? Or you can bring, when I experience this quality of happiness, peace, safety, how does it feel in my whole body and mind? So just connecting to the quality. And so for each of the quality, the Buddha said it was an antidote. So for example, loving kindness is an antidote to fear. So when we're afraid, then everything becomes dangerous. And that only everything feels unsafe. And so in a way, we see danger everywhere. And it could be because they are dangerous, so then we want to be careful. Or it could be that actually it's more the fact that there is some unpleasant feeling to it, and that they become a little anxious, because each of us have different way to be with things. So some unpleasant feeling tone can lead to fear, other to anxiety, other to anger, other to feeling low, feeling sad. So we have different effects from this feeling tone. And so in a way, fear, it's interesting fear. Is it fear now because something is frightening? Or is it fear because I am frightening myself in advance? Then there is a question, what is fear? It's a feeling, which actually is a function. Fear is a function. It's a creative function of the organism to enable us to survive. So at one level, fear is a good idea. Fear tells me, be careful, don't jump in the lake. You know, it might be a bit cold. It has not frozen too much, so it could be a little dangerous. So I am careful and not jumping into the lake right now. So fear is saying, be careful. But then fear can just be a funny feeling associated with unpleasant feeling too. So you feel, I feel funny. I must be afraid. But afraid of what? And so if it's not very strong, then the mindfulness can help us to be with the unpleasant feeling tone, to be with the fear, and in a way not amplify it, not make it bigger than it is, because we can easily do that. We have a great tendency to generalize. And so the fear can also become generalized. And then we can easily be afraid. Is this going to continue? Am I going to be sick like that the whole time? Etc., etc., etc. It can go in many different places. And so the loving kindness as an antidote is actually an antidote not to the fear itself, but to the amplifying. It's saying, look, At times you can be happy. At times you can be safe. At times you can be at peace. Not all the time, but some of the time. So in a way, the loving kindness meditation is to remind us of a certain direction, of a certain intention, of a certain possibility. So it's kind of reminding us of that. And then it brings a balance with the fear. Then one practice I will bring will be the appreciative joy, the rejoicing. And the Buddha said that practice is an antidote to envy. Often we feel that other people have everything and I have nothing. And you feel, they have more. I want that because they have it and I don't. And so often we have this again. We look more at what other people have than at what we have. And then with that, there is a lot of things we don't have that they have. But the question is, do we really need what they have? And if we had it, would it really make a difference? And so in a way, here it's starting from, instead of looking, if only I had this, if only I had that, it's turning it around and saying, okay, what do I have? What is it I can appreciate in my life now? What is it I can be grateful for in my life now? So it's kind of, again, moving a little the balance. It's kind of really bringing a little, look, you look that, and this is in a way pleasant feeling tone with what other have. Because you see something over there, you think, that looks nice. And because it looks nice, it feels nice, if I had it, it would give me that nice feeling all the time. But we know it doesn't last very long, you know? You get whatever it is, and it's nice to have it. I mean, after many years, because it takes me a long time to get things, I thought, okay, this year, I'm going to get an iPad mini so that it'll be less heavy to carry when I travel because I have pain in the back. So finally I got it. And I did not think so, but I fell in love with it within 2 days. This was it, you know. And I had another old iPad. I mean, the poor thing. No. This one, woo! And it was light. It was wonderful. But it's nice. But it's not going to sort my life out. And it's not going to give me the same pleasant feeling tone all the time, even if I appreciate to have it. So we have to be careful. Because this kind of envy, if I had this, if I had that, then that it's kind of like going to transfer something. And then the Buddha say, I mean, you can enjoy what you have, but what are all the things we can appreciate? So in a way, it's kind of like really trying to discover what can we appreciate. And then, of course, there are many different techniques. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh is famous for kind of saying, you know, appreciate the tangerine, appreciate the tree, appreciate your eyes, the fact that you can see, etc., etc., many ways. And then it's interesting that appreciation, how it shifts. And instead of feeling off balance because we don't have all these things, we feel, wow, I have all these things. I'm already rich in many different ways. So bringing balance there. And then you have, the last one is equanimity. And I think with equanimity we have to be careful. Because equanimity often, you might have the impression that we're supposed to be indifferent. We see, often I have this image that with equanimity, you are on a little cloud, a nice little cloud, a little like a boat, little cloud, and it's floating, and you are on your little cloud. I'm fine here. Are you suffering down there? Never mind, never mind. I am fine here, you know. I am in the sky. There is no obstacle, no stormy weather. I mean, fine, my little boat. You know, I am above everything. But that's not the idea. This is really not the idea of equanimity. The idea of equanimity is really to see and know things as they come to be. That's a definition. To see and know things as they come to be. So it's really about creative engagement. To kind of see, and I think to me equanimity is really about stability and balance. What is it that is going to help me to find stability and to find balance? And so again, it's each of us is different. Each of us can find stability and balance in different way. But it's not about let it go, I don't care. That's not equanimity. Equanimity is really this creatively engaging with contact, with balance and some stability. And then it's looking, what is it that helps me to be stable? What is it that helps me to bring some balance? And balance doesn't mean you stay here. Because often I have the impression, people think, you know, I need to reach a state where I am equanimous all the time to the same degree. When I think balance is actually more, you go a little bit this way, you'll go a little bit that way, but you can come back to balance in the middle. So it doesn't mean you stay in the middle, but it means we can come back to the middle. Because our tendency, if we grasp, is that we're going to go overboard. Either this is so terrible, this is so terrible, to this is so fantastic, this is so fantastic. And then from there, if we've so gone, how do we come back? And so here is to say, yeah, you go a little bit there, but not too far. You go a little bit there, but not too far. So it's kind of, what are the elements which are going to help us that way? And so in a way to see that actually what we do in the meditation is about that. Because whenever we come back to the anchor, we don't go so far. This is really, I know this is so simple and you think, oh, the breath again, the body again. You know? I've already come back 10 times. But actually, the effect is in each time you come back. And so it's not a big effect, but over time, it makes a difference. And so the effect is that you don't go too far. Because notice, you sit in meditation and you are fine, but in the thought, you could go through a really bad place. You could imagine all kinds of terrible things. I mean, this is very easy. We can have great imagination and we can go to a really difficult place. But here, with the anchor, we go a little bit and think, maybe I come back now. Maybe I come back now. And that way, you don't go so far. And that way, there is not so much imbalance. And I think it's very important to see that we don't come back to the breath because the breath is sacred, but we come back to the breath to help with cultivating the balance so that we're not too off-center, that we, in a way, can come back more easily to the center, to the balance. And also stability. I think there is something about the meditation process, which is about cultivating in the body and mind some stability. And so, of course, you sit here and you know, 45 minutes, you know, 30 minutes, okay, but 45, you know. But actually, we are doing something. I know it looks like not much is going on, and there are lots of thought or agitation or whatever, but just the fact that you sit there or you walk, actually it builds stability within you. And this is really a treasure, I would say, a treasure within yourself, that you cultivate over time this balance, this stability you can access. And to me, this is some of the thing I do. You can feel here that you're agitated because something happened, because you have some contact. And then the thing to try to do is, how can I access my center? How can I access the ground? How can I access what I have developed over time with the practice of just sitting here, of just showing up, of just being here for 30 minutes, for 45 minutes? This has an effect. And I think the effect is actually physiological in terms of the stability. And then, of course, there is this inquiry. This is really important, the inquiry, to really be aware of change. I think that is a great help with equanimity. It makes a big difference. If you think that something is going to last forever, it's like a huge weight. This is going to last forever. But if you know, at some point, it changes. I have a friend who can have really difficult state. And then she did meditation. And through the meditation, she learned that, yes, I can have difficult state, but they end. They don't last forever. Of course, when I am in the difficult state, it seems there is nothing else. But because she has practiced enough, she knows even in the difficult state, it will stop at some point. And because of that, then there is less grasping, there is less amplification. And so that's why this being aware of change is so important, because it will help us not to amplify, not to grasp so much. And then, then I wanted to talk about a text which is called the Vitakka Santana Sutta. And again, it's a small text you found in the Pali, in the ancient text. And here the Buddha gives five methods, five ways actually to let go. And generally, he does this in connection with thoughts. And so he gives you these five ways to be with difficult thought. But it could be to be with difficult sensation, emotion. It's a bit the same idea. So the first one, so each one he gives you a little kind of saying. So the first one, he tells you, if you have a really difficult thought, you try to replace it with a small positive thought. And he said it's like a carpenter that has a big block, which is a little stuck, and then he takes a small peg and he puts it in a little interstice, a little space, check, and then it makes the big blocks move. So with a small thing, it makes something big move. And I think this is a little bit the effect of the loving kindness, the appreciative joy, the equanimity phrases. I think sometimes they can have that effect. Because if something is difficult, you think everything is difficult, everybody is difficult, I am terrible all the time. And so in a way, what could be the small thing that could remind you they're not difficult all the time, I am not difficult all the time. I am not experiencing this all the time. And so I think that's where, again, change can be so important. Conditionality can be so important to remind ourselves. I seem to repeat the same thing, but I am not like that all the time. Neither them. They're not like that all the time. And then trying to remind ourselves of something good that we did, or a state which was positive. And so in a way, trying to remind ourselves of our good quality, or the good quality of others. Then you have the second one. And the second one, here he says, when you have a very difficult thought, notice that if you follow this thought, you can go to a very dark place. Do you want to go there? So here he's saying, look at the consequences of what we think or feel. And this is saying that in a way, over time, we know ourselves. Over time, we know our trigger. And sometimes there is certain mechanism. You think you're okay, I'm okay, I'm okay. And then something triggers you and you go. And you go into this really dark place. Poor me, nobody loves me. I hate the world. There is no meaning. We can go into very dark place easily, convince ourselves of all kinds of things. And so in a way to see, do I want to follow this thought? This is really, do I want to jump on this train? You know, if you knew the train is going to go off the cliff, you know, you see the train here, the cliff is there, and you know the cliff is going to get there, do you want to go on the train? Are you saying, well, never mind the cliff, I'll get on the train? I mean, if you know the cliff has no barrier and that's where the train is going, possibly not. I don't want to go on the train. So in a way, it's kind of like here, the mindfulness develops, we start to have the clarity. I don't want to go there. And then, of course, I need to help myself. And again, loving kindness could help me. How not to go there? By being kind to myself. There is this fellow who is a famous rock star and who had great difficulty with drugs. And he went to many, many, many recovery. And every time he went again to have more drugs. And then one time, he was quite well for a month. And then suddenly he found himself going to get drugs. And he saw himself. And he actually saw, if I move one step and I go and get the drug and everything, he could see exactly what would happen. The cliff, the train jumping off the cliff. And he thought, however much I want it, do I want to do that? And something within him said, no, I don't want to do this again. I don't want to do this. So in a way, I think part of the thing is to build the power to see the danger and decide, I am not going to go there. But then I need to do something else. And then the third one, the third method is interesting, because there the Buddha says, if something is difficult, turn away from it. Avoidance. Turn away from it. Don't go there. And so I think this is very astute. Because often you get the impression with mindfulness, I must go there, but really go there. And the Buddha said, no, sometimes it's not a good idea. It's too strong, it's too intense, it's too dangerous, it's really, you don't want to go there. and then you turn away. So that's also a skillful mean, to turn away, to put us in another situation in many different ways. Then you have the fourth one, and there it's interesting, because there he said, look deeply into the thought itself and question the thought itself. Could I think something different? Is there something I have not thought about? What is this thought, actually? A little firing in the brain. So it's kind of, in a way, questioning the thought itself. This is an interesting one. And we can, each of us, do this, of course, in a different way. And then the fifth one is sit on it, restrain. And here the Buddha is saying, he has an analogy. He says it's like a big man holding a little man, and the little man agitates himself, and the big man holds him. And to me, this is saying we are more powerful than any one thought. Of course, some thought can be really painful, some feeling can be really painful, some sensation can be really painful, but we are greater than any of them. And I think this is, in a way, the problem with grasping. If we grasp, it gives us the impression that the thought, the feeling, the sensation are bigger than us. They have more power than us. And I think the practice is actually about recovering our power. That, yes, I have a difficult thought, difficult feeling, etc., but I am more than just that. So to see that when we grasp, we're going to reduce. But when we creatively engage, we see we are more than any one thing. And at that level, you recover your power of creative engagement. And my time is up. So, and so I thought, so now there is a little walking period, but I thought for 10 minutes, if anybody had some questions or some comments, I could address them. And then we would just have 10 minutes before the final sitting to stretch the leg and things of that nature. Just if you had any question or comment. Yes.
Are there any specific meditations for practicing equanimity, or is it always through mindfulness?
No. I think the equanimity, I think the quality of loving kindness, compassion, rejoicing, and equanimity can be cultivated directly and indirectly. So you can cultivate it directly through the phrases. Or I believe that if you cultivate mindfulness or meditation in different way, generally you will develop indirectly mindfulness, compassion, etc. So I think there is both possibility that if you meditate, I think over time you develop equanimity, but there is also the practice of cultivating equanimity with the phrases. And so the phrases are, I mean, there are different type of phrases, but the one I would suggest is, may I accept things as they arise, or may I see and know things as they come to be, or may I be stable, may I be balanced. Otherwise, you can make it shorter, accepting things as they arise, being balanced, being stable. And so you could use the sentences. So you repeat the sentences. Accepting things as they come to be, being balanced, being stable. Or you can connect to the experience. So in a way, what is it I can accept right now? Can I accept this thought, this feeling, this sound? Can I experience some balance right now? Can I experience some stability right now? Or you can connect to the quality. When I accept something, how does it feel? When there is some balance, how does it feel? When there is some stability, how does it feel? Where do I feel it? So that would be the way to cultivate directly equanimity.
So where does the like unselfing come to play? Because some of these things sound like they're also means to like distinguish thoughts from being yourself, being your whole self and all that. But is that like all, or are there more? Is there something more you could say about like unselfing?
Yeah, I think personally, I think the practice of meditation is about, in a way, cultivating a skillful sense of self. So it's not saying that there is no self, because each of us, our own self, made from different conditions. So, I mean, different practices do it in different way, that unselfing. So again, you can do it directly or indirectly. Personally, I feel it's kind of like, if we come back again and again to the anchor, then you come back to yourself within a wider environment. So I am here, this flow of conditions, inner condition meeting outer condition. So if I come back to the breath, I come back to all the elements that forms me. And then you can have a much more complex experience of yourself. And what is interesting is we can see when we reduce the self, when you reduce, you kind of, you go into a story, you go into a story and you make a story about yourself or about yourself and other people. And then you can see, oh, that's me. Or when you reduce, oh, I have this pain in the knee, this is me. And then the thing can reduce to that. So it's interesting at that level to see, when do I reduce the self to one element which constitutes it? And how is that a little kind of narrowing? And at the same time, there is this intensifying effect of the thought, the sensation, etc. But there is also, in terms of, to me, what was very revelatory when I did the practice I did, which was different in Korea, was that over time, I became more aware. And I became more aware of my thought. And I became more aware of what my thought were saying. And what I realized was my thought were about me. And I was basically in the thought was saying, what about me? Look at me, me, me. And then you realize a lot of the selfing in part come from thought. But I would say over time, I could see there is two type of thought. You have what I would call the functioning thought, which are just creative functioning. You think, you imagine, you plan, you judge, and then that becomes automatic and a little too augmented. But on top of that, you have a whole layer of thinking which is not very useful. And this level is about me, kind of what I think about me, what others think about me, what they think, I think about them and me, and, you know, and kind of like, you are you. I don't think we need so much to think about us. You see, because we experience ourselves all the time. Do on top of it, do we have to think about ourselves? I mean, this is kind of like adding, you know, more soup to the thing. And my feeling is that with the meditation, with the coming back, with the looking at the change, we actually dissolve that level of thought. So that if we don't have that anymore, then we have so much more space. The electricity can do things much more interesting than describing yourself or describing yourself to others or what you think other things, or if all that goes, then you have more creative functioning. So I think there are many different aspects to how do we self? How is it a useful, healthy selfing? And how is it a necessary selfing? I think there are many different aspects to it. And maybe we'll stop here. And then now we have 20 minutes where we can stretch the leg, go outside, have a little fresh air. And then, of course, if you're too tired, you can go and rest. If you're not too tired, you can come back here in 20 minutes and we'll have the final sitting.